The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Well, you're very welcome to The Debrief, where we look back at some of the biggest stories of the week. And today I'm joined by political editor with the Irish Examiner, Elaine Loughlin, public policy advisor, Oisín Cotlin, and artist, architect and lecturer at TU Dublin, Roisin Murphy. You're all very welcome to the show.
Morning.
And I suppose we have to start with the story that dominated the headlines here in conversation, certainly in this programme all week, and that was the violence and the riots that we saw in Belfast. What stood out for you, Elaine? Was it the immediate violence itself or what's sitting underneath it?
Yeah, I think this is constantly, on both sides of the border, it has to be said, is constantly bubbling under the surface. And immediately after that happened, I was obviously in Leinster House this week, and politicians up to cabinet level were quite worried that this might spill over onto the streets of Dublin. And we did have, it has to be said, quite a small protest outside Leinster House this week. Thankfully went off peacefully, and people are entitled to protest and voice their concerns and disgruntlement. It's thankfully we do live in a democracy. But I think when communities do feel disenfranchised with the political system and perhaps feel like they've been left behind, that it can sometimes allow bad actors to come in and perhaps sway public opinion, as we've seen in Northern Ireland, into rioting, into violent behaviour, and, you know, perpetuate these, what are falsehoods about people who've come to our country, about immigrants who are, you know, keeping the, we'll talk about the health service later in this discussion, but who are keeping the health service afloat, who are doing a lot of jobs that we wouldn't have people to fill if we didn't have people coming with skills and talents to this country. But a different narrative around that cohort is put forward, and it's a kind of a them versus us, really dangerous narrative, as we've seen in Belfast.
As you say, as we've seen in Belfast, and we saw in Belfast last year when there was those alleged sexual assault allegations, I think, in Portadown. We saw it the year before when there was that awful, awful assault in Southport. And we've seen it here in Dublin, haven't we, in City West and, of course, the Dublin riots. Do you think we're at a risk here that this kind of disorder becomes more normalised, a more normalised part of, some call it protesting, I would call it rioting, in Ireland?
I mean, yes, I think is the answer. There's certainly, we've seen it, as you described, and I think there's a combination of factors here. One is there is just racism. Some of it is just racism. Mm-hmm. There's also, though, bad faith actors who are seeking to exploit real challenges and real issues for either often personal gain themselves in terms of money, but often political leverage, influence, attention. We live in an attention economy, and they you combine that with the power of social media. And I say the power, but I also mean the divisive power, as in it's designed for engagement, it's designed for extremism, it's designed for division. And those bad faith actors use it, and their messages get amplified and the extremes get amplified. On top of that, we had an actual owner of a social media company who should have been busy becoming a trillionaire, deciding to spend his time inciting agitation on the streets of Belfast. That's Elon Musk. And then, of course, in Belfast in particular, there is a long tradition of recreational street activity in the summer. So it's a tinderbox waiting to happen in Belfast in particular. But the more general trends are as we described. I would say it's worth remembering, like, the numbers, like, to get the context here, because there are people who are trying to exploit this situation. I was just looking at the figures. In terms of international protection applicants, it's been about, it got up to about 10 or 12, 13,000 or so as a peak in Ireland. But it's mostly been under 10 or under 5,000. It's like less than 10% of the migrants who come every year, as they work in our health services mostly. And it's roughly comparable to how many Irish people go to Australia every year. And we don't see, you know, international consternation about Irish people going to Australia. And yet we are focusing hugely on international protection applicants coming to Ireland. And there's no evidence that migrants, either international protection applicants or general migrants, have higher crime rates than others. And in fact, there was a ERSI study this week saying they claim welfare less often, if not at most the same, as Irish citizens. So there's a lot of false information being used to try to stoke division.
The problem is that any reasonable conversation that people want to have about whatever fears that they have following on from these really serious attacks and these really serious assaults They get lost, don't they? Because the oxygen is sucked up by these protests. And I think people are fearful then of having any sort of a conversation in case they are seen to condone that violence in any way or indeed stoke up that violence further.
I totally agree with you. I think that one of the things is that partly because of Trump, partly because of the we're in as Oisin identified, a culture of social media, that we're not able to disseminate what actually is happening and what's causing it, or even to say it out loud, that a lot of this is caused by right-wing politics. And it's very difficult to talk about that because we're seeing on the other side, 6th of January with Trump and the voting, and there was a riot and, you know, they all kind of crowded up on Capitol Hill, and he's made all of those people taken back out of prison. So the culture that's around at the moment is very aggressive. There's a violence within the kind of ether of humanity that is very scary. But the problem is that at the same time, the social media, you kind of think like take their phones off them. I know that sounds so simplistic. Sometimes they seem this, particularly the voices that come in on top of it, you just feel like saying, right, okay, Elon Musk, just nobody go on Twitter again, that we actively have to kind of push back against it. But just pushing back at it and saying, oh, it's terrible, isn't strong enough. Actively, we have to engage with the problem of social media, ask ourselves, you know, how do we do this as a collective, really push back against the political, because it's coming top down. It's not just coming bottom up. And in the middle of all of this, we have this complete, you know, AI is coming, all this other stuff, and we are like turkeys voting for Christmas.
One simple regulation, because we're not going to ban social media, is to turn off the recommender algorithms, which people like the Hope and Courage Collective, who work with communities to kind of stave off extremism, have been recommending it, because it spirals, you know, it's what gives you toxic information to boys and dieting information to girls so quickly when you join. It's this death spiral. Yeah.
I just wonder though, Elaine, is there political reluctance to address some of the underlying causes here because they're so complex? And are we underestimating the role of housing stress and deprivation and segregation in fueling these flashpoints when attacks like this happen?
Well, look, you can't blame the government or politicians for racist elements out there, but you can certainly blame the government and successive coalitions for the lack of movement on housing. And we even had the housing minister out this week saying, yes, homelessness is going to be a problem for the coming years. And he doesn't seem to have, James Brown, have any real plan to address that. Like, he's acknowledging it's going to get worse, and we've over 17,000 people in homelessness now. So if you have that strain on the housing market right the way from people trying to get a mortgage to those trying to rent, to those in emergency accommodation, families with kids in hotels or homeless hubs right now and going from pillar to post and hoping that that bed is still available for them tonight, and the housing minister doesn't really have any concrete timelines or plans to get those people out permanently.
And on that point, just in terms of migration, it's incredibly important that people realise that we have got a huge crisis in the construction sector. We do not have enough people with shovels. We do not have enough. We need inward migration to help solve the housing crisis. So the problem of migration is not the factor that they keep trying to parse it into a problem with, you know, that the, you know, these people are getting a house, I'm not getting a house. So there's this completely wrong rhetoric around migration could really help inward migration could really help solve the retrofit problem, the cost of housing, the provision of housing. And the problem with the provision of housing is really how it's being provided. It's not the cause of the people and the numbers on the housing list. It's the cause of the economic framework that we are looking at to solve the housing crisis. Sorry, but it's just we have 14,000 people really needed in construction, and they can come. We have people trying to come to our country. Like, let's use them.
Let's move on to one of the other debates this week. It was over private versus public maternity care, and the Rotunda Hospital eventually reversed its decision on private practice for consultants who are on the new public only contract. Elaine, was this debate really about choice?
I think it was for many women who have gone through perhaps complicated pregnancies, who have had miscarriages, who perhaps have had a real struggle to get pregnant in the first place. And I think the issue here is Sláinte Care is a decade-long transformation of the healthcare system that was agreed cross-party. And it really would give us the type of healthcare system, if introduced completely that everybody, I think, could aspire to, where no one is treated differently based on whether you have private health insurance or whether you can pay. The problem is here that I think the maternity services are in a unique position that they will become null and void privately because of Sláinte Care, as opposed to you'll always have your private hospitals for if you want to get your cataract done or your hip replaced. Regardless of whether Sláinte Care is in existence or not, that will always be there in tandem with it. And also people are concerned that, yes, Sláinte Care does represent, I suppose, a utopia. And in order for it to work properly, I think you will need to level up services rather than come down. So if the public health service was there and could perhaps offer a woman who was very concerned, had perhaps had mental health issues or had a complex pregnancy, that she would get that continuity of care throughout her pregnancy in the public health service, why would she choose private? That's not there at the moment. Now, if we do have a situation that we can offer that type of service to women, I think this issue wouldn't have been as, I don't think it would have sparked as much fury or anger. And another point I want to bring into this is I think many people, women, families, didn't actually realise that this was happening. So it's again, it's going back to messaging similar to the messaging around migration in this country, that perhaps the general population, until the consultants and the master of the Rotunda spoke out about this service is going to end, people weren't actually aware of that.
I have to say, in a lot of the coverage this week, Roisin, I thought there was a certain level of judgment, implicit judgment 100%. About women who chose private maternity care, in the way that there's not if somebody chooses private care to get their MRI on their sore knee from running or get their cataract 100%. Removed or get their hip removed. Yeah. Replaced.
I'm sorry, I actually thought it was, I mean, there are. It is so important to keep private care in the Rotunda. I'm probably a voice against them, but I had all my babies in the Rotunda. I had the thing, the worst service ever. Sorry, Rotunda, semi-private, don't go there. My mother's a midwife. She had them in Mount Carmel. Like, women's right to choose private healthcare. And also, there are an awful lot of people who wouldn't find their way into town unless their private obstetrician was in the Rotunda. And we actually need that kind of mixed bag in town to keep town alive, to keep people coming in with their SUVs. I'm sorry, I always bring it back to urbanism, but I am telling you, and there's a secret, even a little secret stairs up the back of the Rotunda for people's families to, like, we have a history of women's kind of messaging about, like, I mean, first of all, the public system is excellent in Ireland.
Like, I've lots had of people who've been through the semi-private and the private, notwithstanding your experience, but have had a great
experience at the Rotunda. They examined, I had a baby with a fetal abnormality in the heart. They were able to go in, examine it. Everything was free. They were even able to say, your fetal child, your baby's very good looking. I said, it's not possible you can see. No, we see some really ugly ones, they told me. I am telling you, I actually think...
Flattery is what you pay for, obviously.
Why the hell are they... Why are they getting involved? Let them have... We need it. We need also...
Okay, Oisín's putting his hand up here.
Well, although, I didn't think I'd be putting my hand up in this debate, but we live in a free society. Everyone has a right, if they can afford it, to go looking for private healthcare. But what I don't think is the case is that the state and the taxpayers in the majority don't have to subsidise and fund that. And the issue here is that the public system, the public health system, is subsidising and facilitating private healthcare still across the board. And in this case, particularly, the question was whether consultants who had contractually agreed, they'd signed a document to say we will only do public health care, and then their boss was saying, actually, don't mind that, we'll do private health care here as well.
Well, that's not fair.
But that is what was happening.
Well, no, they had a separate contract, and in the hospital is allowed, sorry, but I did listen to all the podcasts on this, because I actually think that we do it with education, we do it with so many other things in Ireland. We can't hold women's health to ransom like this.
The Minister for Health, who's a woman, Jennifer Carolyn, was clear that that clause, which was at the hospital level, was specifically for emergencies, and the individual contracts were very clearly said they can only do public healthcare. And the issue, and I mean, there is this fact that one of the issues here is insurance, which is why I understand Mount Carmel closed, is that In other places, you go and have a whole private hospital on its own and they get insurance for that. They can't get insurance. They can't afford insurance.
So it's the end, private healthcare, maternity care.
Not in the short term, because lots of doctors are still on the old contracts. But the issue is, as Elaine said, we need to get to a situation where everyone has the right to the same healthcare. Because the master was saying, everyone gets the same care in the Rotunda. There's no difference, really.
And then saying,
but everyone's safer if some women are paying for private healthcare, which did not make sense.
Who actually do you think holds ultimate accountability about decisions being made in the hospitals?
Well, you can see that definitely the consultants and the masters have a lot of clout when it comes to decisions. But unusually, I think this week we did see the minister coming out. And I think previously, perhaps they were little kingdoms across the country where, as I said, masters of hospitals rule the roost. But Jennifer Carroll McNeill does seem to be coming out strongly now and setting down the rules and making sure that they are adhered to. She's definitely, she's made enemies now with the master of maternity hospital, with consultants, with pharmacists, with the board of the Mater Hospital. And she's only been in there a short time. It remains to be seen, though, whether she has chosen the right battles and whether perhaps she will make an enemy of herself on behalf of the general public for the betterment of the health service. I think it's too early in the day to see whether, as I said, she's picked the right battles there.
Just before we go on this, Virginia, I know you wanted to mention, because there was some breaking news while we were in air, the wonderful, iconic British artist David Hockney has died, 88 years of age.
Yes. Oh, he's such a legend. I mean, I think everybody remembers when we were talking about it outside was the swimming pool one, where it's just he described that kind of LA sunshine, the two bodies in the pool, and then his my favourite was Mr. and Mrs. Clark with Petulia, which is a painting with the two guys. It's an interior one, so it perfectly captures postmodern interiors and a shag carpet, which unfortunately has gone out of fashion due to all sorts of allergies. But for that moment, she's in a sort of a lot. It's just he describes the beginning of postmodernism and ice cream and all of those colours. I was saying he reminds me of a kind of an era of pop music, and so prolific and so profoundly talented.
And so damn cool, wasn't
he? And so damn cool.
All right, we're going to have to leave that there for now. But my thanks to Elaine Lachlan, Oisin Coughlin and Roisin Murphy for joining me for the debrief. Now, before I go, a reminder to check out the very latest episode of Never Have I Ever, with thanks to O'Brien's Wine. This week, Claire got to hang out with the actor and teacher Rob Murphy, and she learned that you need a good catchphrase or two.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, yes, I do.
Sammy, show us your sausage. Oh, no, you didn't.
I swore by my
Very good, Claire.
It's not bad, is it?
Yeah, fabulous. There you go.
Love it.
Well, if the broadcasting career doesn't work out for Claire Byrne, we know where we can see her on a panto stage. Don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Search for Never Have I Ever on the Go Loud app or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.